Willkommen auf der Insel Eternum. Eine Welt, deren wertvolle Rohstoffe du kontrollieren kannst. Fertige mächtige Waffen. Schmiede Allianzen. Und wirke tödliche Zauber. Willkommen zu New World. Bestimme dein Schicksal. Eternum wartet. Sieh dir New World auf Steam oder Amazon an. USK 16.
Welcome to Naked Astronomy, a space science podcast from the Naked Scientists. This season, we're tackling the big questions from our very big universe. That means that each episode, I, Ben McAllister,
and I, Adam Murphy, will take a look at one of the biggest cosmic questions in the world of space science and astronomy today.
We'll break down the basics for you and then pull in an expert guest for a more in-depth chat.
Last month, we were talking about string theory and the hunt for a theory of everything.
This month, we're looking away from particles and back into deep space as we talk about searches for extraterrestrial life.
Are there ETs? Do they phone home? And how would we know?
We've got a special expert guest joining us a bit later to take us through some of the deeper details.
Oftentimes when people think about SETI, they think about Jodie Foster in Contact with the headphones sitting next to the very large array in New Mexico.
But before that, we're going to cover some of the basics.
You know, just the really basic stuff about contacting aliens.
Oh yeah, dead simple. Feel free to get in touch with us along the way on Twitter, at Naked Astronomy, or at Naked Scientists, or leave us a comment wherever you're listening. But without further ado, let's get into it.
So it probably comes as no surprise, seeing as this seems to be a bit of a common theme with many of the episodes we talk about here, but hunting or trying to discover extraterrestrials or life coming from the vast heavens above us has actually been something that many ancient human cultures have been interested in about as long as there have been humans. Again, I mean, it seems like every episode we start saying something like this. I guess we're just very interested in looking at space, and it's very natural human of us to think, I wonder if there's any other life out there. And a lot of that early belief we're not going to dwell too much on here. A lot of it is wrapped up in religious or spiritual beliefs. And then as civilizations became more technologically developed, and particularly the field of astronomy became more technologically developed, we started to gain a deeper understanding of our place in the universe. We came to understand that there are other planets, and then much, much later, other galaxies as well. And that completely reframed the way we thought about the possibility of alien life in the universe.
And then in the 19th century, we began to have, you know, vaguely scientific ideas about what we might do to communicate with aliens. And, you know, if they don't speak our language, they might not even think the same way we do. But it was thought that one thing that might be in common is maths. Wherever you are in the universe, 1 + 1 would have to equal 2. And one idea was, in the Siberian tundra, to draw this massive triangle, a right-angle triangle, that fit Pythagoras' theorem.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild idea, but it is interesting, right? I mean, the aliens wouldn't call it Pythagorean theorem if they were out there looking at Earth, but they would certainly be aware of it. I mean, they wouldn't have telescopes and spaceships if they weren't aware of Pythagoras. So it's not, you know, that silly an idea, even though it may seem a little bit silly.
No, they'd know that was important, at the very least, and we knew that it was important. It wasn't just random.
Yeah, and it's like one of the things, I mean, again, it's going to be a recurring theme here, but I guess you could say that that's something that would be obviously non-natural, something that had one of these, like, mathematical theorems associated with it. So it would be a really interesting way to try and communicate with a species that doesn't speak any human language.
Yeah, because, you know, there are no Pythagorean trees that are going to grow to that.
Yes, that would be a bit strange. And then things only proceeded to get more, I guess you'd say, scientific from there. Interestingly enough, the famed scientist Nikola Tesla repeatedly claimed that his inventions, Tesla coils and the like, could be used to pick up alien radio signals. Now, again, this was the sort of thinking that came with a more technologically advanced society. We understood that we were generating radio waves and radio signals all the time, and thought that maybe aliens would be doing the same thing. And Nikola Tesla said, maybe you could use some of my stuff to do that. Again, as astronomy developed, there were other sort of indications that became interesting. We've talked on this program before about Giovanni Schiaparelli, who insisted that he saw canals on Mars with his very good telescope, which sort of sparked more interest in trying to detect aliens. And then, of course, there is the huge prevalence that has been going around for quite some time, several hundred years at least, since, I think even as far back as the 15th or 16th century, documented claims of UFO sightings. And although they are old, they've certainly become more common in the 20th century.
The one of the ones that's really interesting is that one in the 16th century over Nuremberg in Germany, where there were just lights filling the sky, and the newsprint from the time is really interesting because there's just a really grumpy sun with a face on it, surrounded by all these lights going on in the news in the newspapers.
Yeah, that's right, and so it's been a thing that people have been thinking about for a while. Like, could there possibly be aliens in these unidentified flying objects? But it really entered the cultural zeitgeist in the 20th century.
Zeitgeist is one of my favorite words. I love it. And then beyond then, you know, you've got when media became a thing that everyone consumed, there were huge amounts of pop culture and fiction and movies and radio plays and all this kind of stuff coming out that were full of aliens and what men from other planets would look like. H.G. Wells would write about it. And then in 1938, probably the most famous one was Orson Welles and his radio play of War of the Worlds, and when it was pretended that, you know, maybe the aliens were actually invading. And while the hysteria that came from that is overstated, most people did know it was a play, it was still a big thing that stays in our consciousness today.
Yeah, so I guess throughout the 20th century, we had, in parallel, astronomy tools were getting more and more developed, our science at looking at space was getting better and better, and the general public interest in aliens and extraterrestrials and them maybe having visited Earth or maybe just being somewhere else in the universe was ramping up as well, and that led to the birth of a whole field of science which is called SETI for short, SETI, S-E-T-I, standing for Searches for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
And these days we have a lot of brilliant tools that can help us find aliens if they're out there. So SETI isn't just one field of science. There's a load of little branching things. You know, there's visible telescopes just looking out there. There's theoretical physics. You know, what would these aliens look like? Why would they speak to us? How many of them are out there in the vast blackness? And arguably, though, one of the biggest ones harks right back to Nikola Tesla and his radio telescopes.
Yeah, that's right. Definitely one of the most popular tools for searching for extraterrestrial intelligence is, as we mentioned before, this older idea to look for radio waves. Just want to give a quick shout out to our Square Kilometer Array episode that came out a couple of months ago, where we talked about the development of the biggest radio telescope in human history, the Square Kilometer Array, and a bit about radio telescopes in general. So if you want to know a bit more about them and how they work, go check out that episode. So radio telescopes are certainly one of the most popular ways that we search for extraterrestrial intelligence today. And there are a bunch of places doing SETI work these days, but one of the oldest and biggest is known as the Berkeley SETI Research Center.
We were fortunate enough to get to chat to Andrew Semien, director of the Berkeley SETI Research Center.
Yeah, he was great. He ran us through the ins and outs of the really cool work that they're doing there.
But first, he told us a little bit about where SETI as an institute, and not just a field of science, came from.
As long as there have been humans, we have looked up at the night sky and wondered whether or not we're alone. That question of asking, is there anyone out there, whether it was the forest or the mountain nearby or eventually looking into the night sky, is something that has really always been with us. We generally mark the first, what we call modern search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which is really the first search that could have succeeded around 1959, when two very exciting things happened in the field. One, there was a seminal paper published by a couple of astronomers, Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison, that described a way in which one could conduct a search for extraterrestrial intelligence using radio astronomy that would basically show that humanity could be detected at interstellar distances if someone were looking back at us with a suitable kind of radio telescope. And also around the same time, a very famous person in the field of SETI, Frank Drake, conducted the very first SETI search at wavelengths that could actually transit interstellar space around 1420 megahertz. So that was really the beginning.
Is that Drake equation? Is that Drake equation, Frank Drake?
Yeah, the same one. Yeah, exactly. They say that that's the second most famous equation in physics, just second only to E equals MC squared.
Yeah, that's probably true in terms of people who've heard of it. Absolutely. Yeah, so that's great. We'll get into some of those particulars of how those various searches work in a minute. But I also just wanted to clear something up, because I've been, when I talk to people about SETI and searches for extraterrestrial intelligence, there seems to be, like, some people think of SETI as an organization. And of course, there are SETI organizations, but also SETI, of course, just stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So can you sort of clear up the distinction there? I understand there are multiple different SETI organizations around the world.
In the very early days of SETI in the 80s, obviously there was a lot of administrative and programmatic organization going on. And there was a group of scientists that were largely based at the NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View in California, where I live, that were doing a lot of SETI work, and they needed a home. So they were kind of an entrepreneurial bunch. And so they formed their own research organization in order to carry out SETI searches. And they called it the SETI Institute. So SETI, of course, is an acronym that stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, but the last letter is an I. And so if you make an organization called the SETI Institute and the last letter of the acronym of the first word is an I, it's very easy for people to conflate the term SETI with the Institute. And even now, when you ask many astronomers about SETI, they immediately think of the SETI Institute. And even people that work at the SETI Institute will often say, well, I work at SETI. Just as shorthand. But of course, SETI is much more than just one institution or even one country. It is an entire field of study. And as we sit here today in 2021, there are research groups addressing this question based all over the world, many, many dozens of different research groups. And in fact, now something that actually has changed in the last 10 years or so is that the majority of the scientists, the majority of the activity going on in this field is actually not at the SETI Institute. It's more at these other research groups around the world.
Okay, so thanks for clearing that up. I just want to get like a very sort of baseline level for those who this is the first they're hearing about this kind of thing. How do you search for an extraterrestrial intelligence? What do you actually do here on Earth?
Right, well, this is a great question. So basically what we do in SETI is we imagine that if there is other intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, and like us, they have developed some form of technology, they're using tools in some way, and they're using those tools at a scale that could be detected at interstellar distances, we ask the question, well, how could we detect that tool use? And of course, one of the most important tools that we use here on this planet that turns out to be very, very detectable at interstellar distances is electromagnetic tools that create electromagnetic radiation, like powerful radars that we use at our airports, radio communication systems that we use to communicate with distant spacecraft, and even in some cases, optical communication systems that we use to communicate with spacecraft that are relatively close by to the Earth. These tools emit electromagnetic radiation that leaks past our planet. And again, if another civilization were looking back at us with a large telescope, they could detect those things. So we kind of turn this phenomena around and imagine if these other civilizations are out there and they're using tools like we are, then we might be able to detect them. And indeed, that's what we do. We use our large telescopes to look for this tool use. Now, of course, there's a wide variety of possible manifestations of technology. A lot of what we do in SETI focuses on technology that's very close to what we have developed here on this planet, like the examples I already gave of radio and optical communication systems. But we also occasionally think about things that are maybe 100 or 1,000 years into our future. For example, suppose we build gigantic space stations in our own solar system, and we have large solar collectors, for example, in orbit around our star, something called a Dyson structure, named after a very famous science fiction futurist and physicist, Freeman Dyson.
But not the vacuum person.
Right. Indeed, a different Dyson. We can look for these as well. We can use the same kinds of telescopes like the Kepler satellite and the TESS satellite that we use to look for extrasolar planets, to look for large structures, artificial structures in orbit around other stars. So while oftentimes when people think about SETI, they think about Jodie Foster in Contact with the headphones sitting next to the very large array in New Mexico, we certainly do a lot of that. But also this search can encompass a very wide variety of possible modalities. Again, always just targeting some form of very large scale tool use, some kind of technology.
I have to say my first film exposure was Eric Avari in Independence Day at the very start. That was my first exposure to SETI. Is that what Breakthrough Listen, which is one of the projects at SETI Berkeley, is that the kind of thing it's doing?
Yeah, that's right. Breakthrough Listen primarily targets electromagnetic radiation that is released from technology deliberately. That doesn't necessarily mean that the civilization is deliberately trying to signal us, but that the electromagnetic radiation being released by the technology is purposeful for some reason. It could be a directed energy propulsion system. It could be a powerful surveillance radar that ET uses to surveil their own exoplanetary system, or it could be a directed communication being sent to other civilizations. And we conduct that search across the electromagnetic spectrum from the lowest radio frequencies that get through our ionosphere, around 30 or 40 megahertz, all the way up to millimeter and even submillimeter wavelengths in the radio, and also at optical wavelengths using a variety of optical telescopes, including 2.4 meter telescope here in California called the Automated Planet Finder, and also a space-based telescope, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or the TESS satellite.
Is there any plan to use the Square Kilometer Array for any kind of searches like this? We've spoken to some of the people who work on that on this program. That sounds like a promising radio telescope tool.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you asked that question, Ben. The answer is emphatically yes. And in fact, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence has been a motivating principle in many ways for the entire Square Kilometer Array project. Of course, having a telescope with, you know, 10 times the sensitivity of our best radio telescopes now is naturally very, very exciting for SETI searches. And there's actually something really very special about the Square Kilometer Array and about the sensitivity that we'll actually get to when we have the full Square Kilometer Array, is that this would be the very first telescope that we've ever built that would be sensitive to what we call leakage levels of radiation. When we talk about the detectability of our technology, oftentimes we use as a proxy our most powerful radio transmitters. And indeed, some of our most powerful radio transmitters could be detected across the entire galaxy in the experiments that we do. But the reason why they're so detectable is because they beam a large amount of electromagnetic radiation in just one small spot on the sky. They focus a lot of radiation. Like a radar takes a megawatt of power and it puts it into a little tiny dot. And what that means, if we're looking for it, is that we have to be in the beam of that radiation in order to detect it. So the probability that we might be in that beam might be fairly low. But we also release what we call leakage radiation, which is isotropic, omnidirectional. It goes out in all directions, but it's much, much, much weaker. Well, it turns out, if you work through the numbers, that the Square Kilometer Array has enough sensitivity that if there were a civilization like ours in orbit on a planet around Alpha Centauri or Proxima Centauri, the nearest stars to the Earth, we could detect that leakage radiation if we had the sensitivity of the Square Kilometer Array. So when you hear jokes about, you know, listening for I Love Lucy or some early TV transmissions, the truth is that we couldn't actually detect those with our current generation of experiments, just not sensitive enough. But with the SKA, we could.
That's amazing. That's really exciting as a prospect for the future of this work. So, of course, the universe is full of electromagnetic background radiation, right? So if you're looking at space with a radio telescope, how do you distinguish a potential SETI candidate signal from everything else out there?
What we use is a property called coherence. So most of the natural sources of electromagnetic radiation that we see, be they in the radio or the optical or at other wavelengths, ultimately arise from the random motions of particles, the random motions of electrons or molecules in a gas. And that causes the radiation to be spread out in time or in frequency. It sounds like static. If you were to listen to it, it would just sound like a shh, like just a hiss.
Like all frequencies at the same time.
That's right. Yeah, like white noise, like over a broad range of frequencies and not changing much over time. But technology does something very different to electromagnetic radiation. It has the ability to compress it in time or in frequency. So it's very easy, for example, for an artificial radio source to emit radiation at only one frequency, only one place on the radio dial, just like a radio station that you would listen to in your car or a TV station that you might tune into if you're one of the few people that still has a television that receives over-the-air transmissions. So we use that special property of artificial radiation as kind of a sieve, and we look for specific emission that has that high degree of what we call spectrotemporal structure, or structure in frequency or in time.
And how would you distinguish that from something like a naturally occurring single frequency, like the hydrogen line or something that's used a lot in radio astronomy?
Or I was thinking pulsars, which are very constrained in time as a set of frequencies.
Yeah, so I'll start with pulsars, which is a wonderful example of something that we see in astronomy that does have a high degree of coherence. Because of the way that pulsars arise from a rapidly rotating neutron star with a very large moment of inertia, it emits a very regular lighthouse stream of pulses. And in fact, it's somewhat apocryphal tale, but not entirely apocryphal. When pulsars were first discovered, they were termed LGM-001 and LGM-002 for little green men. When those sources were discovered, they showed such a high degree of coherence, such regularity. It was unlike anything that had ever been seen in radio astronomy before. Some people thought that they must be artificial. Of course, now we know that they're not. Pulsars represent one of a very rare set of examples of naturally occurring astronomical phenomena that show the degree of coherence that we see with technology. So natural spectral lines like the 21 centimeter line, although indeed they have a large amount of radiation at just a narrow range of frequencies or wavelengths, they are much, much broader than what can be created by technology. So there's about a factor of 1,000 there between the minimum bandwidth of a naturally occurring signal and the minimum bandwidth of an artificial signal. So we still have about three orders of magnitude of distinction on the spectral line front.
The other thing, then, if we're talking kind of other signals that have come in, the one that I'd like to talk about is the WOW signal that came in 77. This was this signal that came in that someone circled a WOW around as being an alien signal. Could you tell us a little bit about that and where it stands sort of today and what we think?
As you said, in the 70s, there was an experiment at a radio telescope in Ohio called the Big Ear. And that experiment was conducted before the age of digital recording. And so the output of the experiment was, in fact, a printout containing a measure of the intensity of radiation at different frequency channels. And for a brief moment, think about a minute or so, there was a very bright radio signal occurring at only one frequency. Indicator of technology. The problem with that is that the experiment had a very limited ability to tell the difference between artificial signals that leaked in from our own technology and artificial signals that might be coming from some very distant civilization. And this is really the biggest challenge in SETI searches across the electromagnetic spectrum, but particularly in the radio, which is telling the difference between our own technology and the distant signal that we're looking for. When we use our own technology as an example, as a prototype for what the distant technology is going to do, invariably we're going to have a problem sometimes telling the difference between signals from our technology and the other technology. And indeed, the consensus in the astronomical community is that probably the WOW signal was a result of radio frequency interference, of interference from our own technology. But of course, we can't know for sure. There has been a tremendous amount of follow-up of this particular spot on the sky. Nothing has ever been seen again, but we've looked.
All right, so if it's not the WOW signal and it's not those LGM signals you mentioned before, those pulsar signals, is there anything currently out there? Like, what do you think is the best current indication? What's the closest to something that looks like aliens that's currently on the books?
Well, I don't know of anything. If I did, I probably would be too busy to do the podcast. I would be, writing a proposal to use a telescope or building an instrument of some kind. This is not exactly answering your question, but I'll tell you what I think is the most important piece of information that we've learned that drives our searches forward. And that's the ubiquity of extrasolar planets. 20 years ago, if you asked most astronomers how common planets were, most of them would tell you that planetary systems like our own are probably the exception rather than the rule. It's probably very difficult for multi-planet systems to form around stars just because of the dynamics of planet formation and how turbulent that environment can be. But of course, now we know that essentially every star in the Milky Way galaxy has a planetary system, and some, you know, one fifth or one quarter of them has a planet that might be able to have liquid water on its surface. So there's just so much real estate out there that we now know for certain is there. And I think that tells us that the prospects for life forming, if the dynamics that we saw in our own solar system are at all repeated in any way elsewhere, are very, very great. And so I think that gives us a lot of optimism about the possibility that there's life. And I think from the perspective of SETI, the possibility that there could be other intelligent life out there.
Well, then I suppose the next thing I'd ask is, we're talking about receiving, but what if we wanted to send a message? What would you go about sending, and how would you go about sending to something that might not resemble anything we understand?
Yeah, and how do you encode that information in a way that's useful? That's always one that I like to think about. Like, if you ran into an alien and you had to convince it you were intelligent, you know, what do you do?
Yeah, I think this is a question that comes up a lot in this field. There's a bit of a debate ongoing about whether it's a good idea for us to intentionally signal other life if we don't know anything about them or their intentions or their capabilities. A couple of things I would say to keep in mind here. One is that, as I already mentioned, we are constantly leaking electromagnetic radiation out into space. And if you ask the question, well, how should you encode that information? Well, we're transmitting information with all sorts of different types of encoding, some encrypted, some not, you know, some in the radio, some in the optical. We're portraying ourselves and conveying ourselves to the universe constantly and in many, many different ways. And so I think personally, I think if one did want to intentionally signal other civilizations, I think you should take a diverse approach to how you encode the information. And we're doing that by default. I think for me, that one of the most beautiful examples of interstellar communication is the Voyager Golden Record. I think that was a wonderful example of how we can seek to communicate with one voice and try to incorporate as much of humanity as possible into a consolidated form. And I think that if we were to do that again as a civilization, in a concerted way, I think that would be the most important thing, would be to find a way to make sure that our entire planet, our entire human race was represented in some form.
That's a lovely sentiment. But just for those who might not be aware, the Voyager Golden Records, they're some plates on the Voyager satellite and containing a bunch of stuff. Can you say a bit more about what's on them?
Yeah, there's all kinds of images, photographs that have been taken, converted into an analog form and encoded on the record, music, a variety of different pieces of music from all over the world. And for those that are interested, you can actually find the entire contents of the Golden Record online. And
I think
can,
Chuck
can
Berry's
browse
on
it.
There, which is pretty sweet.
I think that's right.
Yeah, Johnny B. Goode is on it.
That's pretty great. And that's what, like, one of the furthest things from Earth that we've produced. So that's very cool that is out there.
I believe that's right. That is the furthest, most distant piece of human technology. And in fact, we use the Voyager spacecraft as a test source in our SETI experiments. And if your listeners are interested, you can go to our website, seti.berkeley.edu, and actually detect Voyager in our data in a little tutorial if you're keen.
That's great. That sounds like a fun thing for people to do. Well, I have one more thing, unless there's anything else you want to add that we haven't covered, which is, we already spoke a little bit about this, but I'm wondering if you have anything else that you would add. What do you think are the future prospects for SETI work? What are you really excited about, other than perhaps the SKA?
Well, this is a great question. I would say two things. Well, maybe three things. So one is that our telescopes are constantly getting more and more sensitive, more and more powerful. Detector technology across the electromagnetic spectrum are enabling us to be sensitive to a much wider variety of signals, much weaker signals than we've ever been sensitive to in the past. And, you know, that doesn't just apply to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That applies to astronomy writ large. And so as our ability to probe the universe and observe the universe improves, so too does the opportunity for discovery of new phenomena, of interesting things. And so I think that bodes very, very well. Another thing that I think is very exciting, which is, this is somewhat of a controversial viewpoint, but I think that the dramatically reduced cost to launch spacecraft that we're seeing because of the advent of commercial space is going to be incredibly important for astronomy. Obviously, there's some consternation about the increasing ubiquity of low Earth orbiting satellites and the possibility that these might interfere with astronomy from the ground. This is very much a valid concern. It's something that we should pay close attention to. But if you look maybe 20 or 30 years into the future, when it becomes relatively inexpensive, for example, to put telescopes on the moon, perhaps the far side of the moon, these are telescopes that would not be encumbered by any of the atmosphere or the ionosphere that obviously encumbers astronomy from the surface of the Earth, but also could be relatively shielded from our own technology, which would dramatically reduce this problem of radio frequency interference. So I think our own exploration of space is ultimately going to enable us to probe other civilizations' exploration of space in sort of equally increased capacities. And finally, I would say that over the last decade, we've seen a real surge of interest in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. When I was a graduate student in 2010, 2011, I was kind of the only graduate student in the world that was working in this field. And it was very, very lonely. You know, now there are dozens of graduate students around the world and postdocs that are working in SETI and many more undergraduate students that are looking forward to a career in the field. And so I think that increase in engagement from students and young scholars is really, really heartening and I think bodes well for the future of the field.
That's it for this month's episode of Naked Astronomy. We hope you enjoyed it and maybe learned something.
It is really an exciting time to be alive with some of those amazing SETI prospects in our very near future.
If you enjoyed yourself, please get in touch with us on social media at Naked Astronomy or at Naked Scientists. Throw us a subscribe or leave us a rating, review, comment, or a like wherever you're listening.
You can also get in touch with us by sending a weak radio signal from the other side of the Milky Way galaxy. Thanks again for listening. I'm Adam Murphy.
I'm Ben McAllister.
And keep watching the skies.
Willkommen auf der Insel Eternum. Eine Welt, deren wertvolle Rohstoffe du kontrollieren kannst. Fertige mächtige Waffen. Schmiede Allianzen. Und wirke tödliche Zauber. Willkommen zu New World. Bestimme dein Schicksal. Eternum wartet. Sieh dir New World auf Steam oder Amazon an. USK 16.